Welcome to Methods, a podcast from the ESRC National Centre for Research Methods. In today's episode, what role might our genes have in decisions about having children? Our guest is Professor Melinda Mills from the University of Oxford and Nuffield College, who's been combining genetic and social science to look at the influence of genes on human behaviour, including fertility.
What we examine is called reproductive behavior. So what that is the timing of, you know, when you decide to have a child or children and the number of children. And what we noticed was there was a really rapid increase in the age at when men and women were having their first children and subsequent children since around the 1970s. So it was really incredible if you started looking at the statistics that they were having children around, depending on the country, 4 to 8 years later within a few decades. So women, for example, are having their first child at a mean age of around 28, 29. So that we found very interesting because we thought, well, you know, as social scientists, demographers, sociologists, psychologists, we often looked into sort of the social factors related to why people are having less children or children later. We looked at things such as, you know, women entering into education or labor market, the introduction of effective contraception, the ability to combine work and family, and, you know, sort of all these social factors. And we thought, okay, that's interesting. We know that that is related to postponement, so having children later and having fewer children. But then we realized that, you know, I was looking at it and I realized, oh, I'm missing an entire biological or genetic component. You know, and I was even talking to some researchers that said, how can you study fertility and reproduction without integrating any sort of biological or genetic component?
So this prompted you to combine this sort of social science and molecular genetic approach. What did that involve? What did that mean?
So that is looking at the actual SNPs or single nucleotide polymorphisms. You know, the genetic loci, the actual genetic loci that are related to reproductive behavior. We first started looking at twin studies, and we knew that there should be some sort of genetic component, maybe around 20 to 50% when we have our first child and the number of children, that must be genetic. And then we started to use whole genome data. And in 2015, we found that, okay, yeah, we can probably, using molecular genetic data, about 10 to 15% of when we have our first child and how many children we have is genetic. So from there on, we realized we should actually find out which genes these are. So we conducted a genome-wide association study.
So where did your information actually come from?
Well, it was 4 to 5 years of just gathering data from multiple sources. So, I mean, we're really lucky in the UK because there's just been an explosion of genetic data that has very good social science indicators as well, like the UK Biobank, Understanding Society, ELSA, the Millennium Cohort will come. So there's just been some excellent data here. So we use that data. But actually, in the end, we were able to gather over 60 different data sets from Europe and North America. We got it from medical studies, from social science studies, but also from very large direct-to-consumer genetic commercial companies. So we combined all of those data sets together.
So a fantastic array of information, as you say, from different parts of the world, from different data sets, you know, very rich data sets. So what did you then do with that? How did you actually carry out the research?
What we did is we combined all of those different data sets together and did what's called a genome-wide association study. And what that is just doing multiple regressions on millions of these genetic loci or SNPs that I talked about before. And it's really important to know that this is really fundamentally different kind of research from the social sciences. So the analysis was conducted in two separate centers for quality control. So we did the analyses and then another quality control center did the analyses just to make sure that we had the correct results. And then you do what's called a meta-analysis. So you do an analysis on all the 60 data sets, and then you do a meta-analysis, which is a combined analysis. And from that, you're able to isolate genetic loci that are related to the outcomes that you're looking at, which in our case was when you have your first child and the number of children.
Yes, and this led to you publishing some very exciting findings in Nature Genetics, one of the top journals for this type of research. What did you actually show?
What we found was 12 genetic loci, so it was really very exciting. And then what you can do with these genetic loci is you combine them together and you create what's called a polygenic score. So for these really complex outcomes that we're looking at in the social sciences, it's never one gene or two genes, it's poly, so it's multiple. So you combine those together and then you use them, you know, in statistical models or to understand what their value is in prediction. So just to give you an example, our polygenic score for number of children ever born. So if you have a genetic propensity to have more children, we found that when we introduced that into models, it could predict about a 9% decrease in remaining childless. So it really seems to have some predictive power, you know, and then we extended this in July 2017. We published an article in the European Journal of Human Genetics, and we showed that for our other polygenic score for age at first birth, so if you had a higher genetic propensity to have children later, you had a 1.3 higher odds to remain childless. This was, you know, sort of interesting, but we always kept our social science hats on, even though we were working in the area of molecular genetics. So in that article, we found that there were sex differences, and then in something we just published in September 2017 in Nature Human Behavior, we actually used these polygenic scores again to show that there's different genes that are related to fertility and educational outcomes across different birth cohorts and countries. So, you know, with our social science hats on, we then use these results to say, hey, there's differences by sex, there's differences by birth cohort. So the genes that would affect my mom deciding to have a child are different than me deciding to have a child. And where you grow up, your country that you come from matters. So I think that's sort of a different approach of how we've applied these scores as well.
Really fascinating insight. So going back to your sort of original work, when it came to when we have our first child, what did the research show about the links with our DNA? And I wonder what it also showed about the question of how many children, you know, we will have. Did it tell us anything about that?
We came into this research project not really knowing if we'll find any genetic loci, you know. So as I said, yeah, we found 12 genetic loci that are related to age at first birth and number of children ever born. So this was really exciting. For age at first birth, we actually found 10 significant loci. 9 were in both sexes and 1 was in women only. And for the number of children ever born, we found 3 significant loci. 2 were in both sexes and 1 for men only. So what's interesting about that, it's not just finding the genes, but the second part of the study, we turned our results over to biologists and molecular geneticists who we worked with closely. And they looked in very detail, okay, so what do these genes do? So this was where it became very interesting. And what we found was the genetic loci that we isolated were related to male infertility. They were related to sperm maturation and function and quality. They were related to the hormones related to fertility, things such as follicle stimulating hormones. And really interesting, they were also related to infertility diseases encountered by women such as endometriosis and polycystic ovarian syndrome. And, you know, so the really interesting findings were a lot of it was for men. So some of the genetic loci we found were linked with methylation and expression of genes that play a role in sperm function. And why I think this is very interesting, and many of the people in the field found it interesting, is a lot of the research on fertility and infertility is focused on women. And a lot of fertility drugs and assisted reproductive technology and IVF, it's a lot is related to women. And what we found is that some of the infertility findings related to childlessness or men having fewer children was really related to male infertility and sperm function and quality. So that's something that we're pursuing further as well.
So in that respect, this really does change what we previously knew and thought about the whole process of having children, right?
Yeah, it's really very fundamental for social scientists, but also in the areas of infertility studies and molecular genetics. So, I mean, on the social scientist side, so often from sociology, demography, psychology, we think about when we have children and the number of children, the theories we develop and the research we examine thinks about things in actually quite a socially deterministic way. So all the theories are about choice, the theory of planned behavior and choosing, or it's about constraints related to childcare facilities or combining work and family. And that all plays a role. But what our research shows is actually there could be up to a 10 to 15% predictive power of genetic factors. And I think the next stage in our research, and what I'm hoping people will use our results for, because we make everything open access so anyone can use our results, is in what environments do these predictors matter? So you might have a certain genetic propensity to have children later or a lower number of children, but it might only be important in certain environments, or it might only be important after a particular age. So it could be that you have genes that make it more difficult for you to have children after a particular age, but you would never know that if you had your children by 28 or 29. So I think, you know, it can be used as predictors and models. It reorients our thinking about theories and methods. And I think, you know, particularly our findings about men and some of these biological insights really change the way that we're thinking and looking at some of these outcomes.
Now, in your study, the genes you looked at predicted sort of less than 1% of the timing and the number of children, which I suppose to us mere mortals might seem pretty low. I wonder if you can explain why it's never nevertheless still a very important and significant finding.
When you're thinking about complex human behavior, about when you have a child or how many children you have, in our case, you shouldn't anticipate that it would be 80% genetic. So there's some traits such as height or BMI or some of these obesity-related traits, because those are partly genetic but also very much behavioral. So if we put these models, the polygenic scores, into our models, it'll predict about 1% of age at first birth or number of children ever born. And our other research shows that we should be able to find actually an upper bound of about 10 to 15%. Imagine, you know, when you used to have an old camera, an old telephone, and you took pictures, and the pixelation, you know, it showed these sort of large squares, and it was hard to see, and the pixelation was quite rough. That's kind of what we did, but now we have more advanced technology and genotyping platforms and imputation, so we get these really crisp pictures with more pixels in them. I think that's the best way to describe it. And we're redoing our study at the moment with, you know, that more increased precision and detail, but now we're actually having a sample size that's much larger, of almost around 1 million. So I can already tell you the results are not published yet, but, you know, in redoing this, we're getting a much higher predictive power. And, you know, and I think that, you know, what I said before, when you enter our polygenic scores into models, you're predicting 9% childlessness. So they really do have a predictive power in, you know, some of our outcomes that we're looking at.
Fantastic. Now, you've already alluded to this a little bit, and it is early days, but I wonder if this discovery does have the potential in the future to help people who may be, for example, finding it very hard to have children. Ultimately, is that the hope?
You know, as I said before, for complex behavioral outcomes, you know, related to decision making and reproductive behavior, it's not just an individual's genetic or social component. It's their partner, of course, too. And we know as social scientists, it's also the institutional environment that they grow up in. So, you know, is there childcare? Is there work-life reconciliation? And all of these things affect, you know, your decision to have children. So we know that there's always a strong behavioral component and environmental component. And I think that's what we add to these genetic studies. So I do think that our models that combine social science and genetics will have a better predictive power. Now, we're looking into things such as how we can combine this data to develop models such as how late can you wait, you know, because that's really what people want to know. Okay, so can I, you know, wait until 28 or 29? Because, you know, some women and men don't have any fertility problems if they wait, whereas some have them quite early. So we're definitely looking at things related to these combined models, looking at that. But, you know, I think particularly the biological follow-up studies are very promising, particularly for men. So we were actually finding things related to sperm function and lower sperm count and quality and hormones related into infertility. And I think that's evaded a lot of the infertility research until now. So the side effect of looking at these behavioral outcomes has been that we've been able to come a bit closer to understanding male infertility and some other factors related to female infertility. So you can't use our results to predict when you'll have a child or how many children you'll have, but we're definitely going into the direction of trying to understand these factors and help people in their ability to have children if they want them.
Melinda Mills was talking to Christine Garrington about her NCRM-funded research, SocGen, combining social science and molecular genetics research to examine inequality and the life course. More information is available under the Research tab on the NCRM website at www.ncrm.ac.uk.